Captain, the Pantoran says.
At ease, pilot,
Wedge says.
Technician, actually. Named Shilmar Igson,
the Pantoran says.
Help you with something?
I'm looking for...
From behind the shuttle's folded wing pokes a face. One smudged with streaks of dark grease. Wedge almost doesn't recognize her.
Captain,
Nora says. She slides under the wing, her knees on a repulsor creeper. She kicks the platform and it floats away. As Nora stands, she wipes her hands with a rag.
Captain?
Wedge asks.
Nora, come on. We're friends.
Oh, yeah. No, of course. I just...
She offers an awkward smile.
Hey, Wedge. It's good to see you again.
She moves to shake his hand, and he moves in for a hug, and neither actually happen. There's that awkward moment where his arms are open and her hand is hanging out midair. They laugh nervously and retreat.
So,
he says, admiring the shuttle,
you're a pilot again.
I am. I work for the Senate. Sometimes they, well, they need rides. Later today I'm taking the, let's see if I get this right, the Special Senator Council on Galactic De-Escalation Strategies. Or is it the Senate Special Council? I can't remember. Either way, they're heading out to Lake Andrasha to convene another meeting.
The peace talks are coming up in a few days.
And the big celebration.
Right, right.
Wedge has been on special security detail for that event. The liberation of the captives of Kashyyyk was a boost in the arm when it came to morale. Some of those prisoners were high-ranking folks from the Rebel Alliance. Many were heroes and liberators in their own right. And freeing them, well, it was decided that such an event demanded a proper celebration. Liberation Day, the Senate voted to call it. The Chancellor's idea. And the peace talks will dovetail with that event. Wedge isn't much of a politician, but even he can see the play there. Peace talks with the Empire are viewed with a great deal of suspicion. He feels it, too. Imperial oppression has fomented a great deal of bad blood over the many years, and those in the New Republic aren't necessarily keen to give the enemy room to move. Having Grand Admiral Sloane here only stirs up that blood. Hell, just thinking of her name makes Wedge's body ache with the memory of what they did to him there in the Satrap's palace on Akiva. That woman deserves no measure of compassion, no moment of kindness. Give her that moment, and he believes she'll use it to flash a knife and cut their throats. Then again, he might be just a little bit prejudiced, which is why he's staying out of it. Either way, a big celebration like Liberation Day will go a long way to cool the hot blood over the peace talks.
It's been a while,
Nora says.
Yeah, it has. Sorry about that. It's just been, well, you know.
Everything's hectic.
Everything's moving fast right now. Light speed fast.
Human emotions are basically a pack of Tuca cats chasing shadows, Wedge decides. He's happy that Nora has her husband. And yet...
So,
Nora asks,
what's up? Everything okay?
He dithers a bit before saying,
I don't think it is.
What? What's wrong?
It's about Temin, Nora.
Temin knocks the last spring bolt into place with the handle of the coil driver, then flips it around and gives the skull one last twist. It buzzes and clicks into place. The red eyes flicker, then strobe, then stay lit. Bones' narrow, vulpine head looks left, looks right, then finally his eyes telescope and focus on Temin.
Hello, Master Temin!
Bones!
He grabs the droid and presses his forehead against the flat of the droid's cold metal head.
Glad you're back, buddy!
I am glad to have no astromech parts.
I know.
Astromechs are meddling weak things. that remind me of trash receptacles or repositories for human waste fluids. They are nearly as useless as protocol droids, who serve no function at all except to talk.
Okay.
Temin laughs.
I get it. Pull back on the flight stick, killer.
He makes a mental note. Tweak Bones' personality matrix. Something must have gotten knocked around in there. The B1's not usually this chatty.
How are you feeling?
I appear to have been modified again.
Yeah, mostly just cosmetic.
The B1's torso got dented in and torn up enough by those drones back on Kashyyyk that Temin decided to lean into the skeletal look and just cut out those dents entirely. Now Bones' torso looks more like a human ribcage, albeit with more spiky bits. He thought about putting one of those droid arms onto Bones. Those whipcord limbs were pretty primo, sophisticated stuff. His father said he could maybe help, but then...
You seem struck with a moment of grief, Master Temin. Please identify the source of this grief, and I will tear it apart as if it were an unsuspecting bug.
I'm good, Bones. I'm fine. Happy to have Dad home.
That's nice. But it does not explain the upset you are demonstrating on your face. Your grief and worry have been ongoing. Explain, please.
What can he say? Things were good. Brenton came home. Mom seemed happy. Temin was happy. They did things together. They went to the zoo out on Serene Island, watched the Pangorans in their grottos, and the scuttling caw crabs splashing about their enclosures, and Dad laughed at the Ooking Oorlangs. They ate dinner every night. Dad even cooked, trying to navigate his way through the strange Chandrillan herbs and spices. Mom and he stayed up late for the first several nights, laughing long into morning. But then, something changed. Somewhere in the apartment, Temin hears the sound. The clatter of utensils on a dish, the hum of the protein cycler, the splash of the spigots.
Stay here, Bones,
Temin says, then heads into the kitchen. It's his father. That still amazes him. His father. Ripped from his life years ago, dragged out of the house in the middle of the night by Imperial forces. It should be amazing. And Temin combats that thought by telling himself,
it is amazing. You're just too selfish to realize it.
But after those first couple of weeks, Dad hasn't been the same. It's like he's not all there. He's still Brenton Wexley. Still sometimes wears that winning smile. Still is good with tools. Still snaps his fingers like Temin does when he's thinking. And he's fast with a joke now and again. But he usually walks with an easy, effortless lean, like he doesn't have a care in the world. And music. Dad always loved music. Temin even went out to a junk shop, which are few and far between here on Chandrilla, as the people view junk as junk and not as the treasure Temin sees it can be, and brought home a small valacord. Dad poked the keys a few times. Hasn't touched it since. The doctors and therapists said this was all normal. Nobody really knows what his mind went through. Far as Brenton Wexley recalls, it seems like he was in stasis for most of those years. Held fast in those cradles and used to power the rest of the prison ship's security protocols. Mom said that the chems they pumped into her made her feel anxious and afraid. And that was just after a few minutes. Who knows what Dad went through, having that cocktail churning through him for years. Might have been an endless nightmare. Still, Dad's back, but he's not back. And that sucks.
Tim, Dad says. Hey, kiddo.
Dad! Hey.
You okay?
Fine. I thought you were supposed to help me today.
Help you?
Then his face twists up like a wrung rag.
With the droid, you're B1.
Right,
Yeah, I'm sorry, Tim. I've just been distracted.
Where were you?
I took a walk. He does that now. He takes walks. Lots of them. Morning, midday, even in the middle of the night. The one therapist, Dr. Chavani, said that was normal too. Said a lot of stuff might have built up in his mind over the years, and this might be his way of shaking it out. Everyone assumed he was dead, and now he's not. He's risen, effectively, from the grave, like a glow-white from the old meteor horror serials.
Well, I can take a walk with you sometime.
No, Brenton says. I think I like to be alone on those walks.
You think?
Everything's not real clear right now, kiddo.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. You and Mom all right?
Sure. But the way he says it, he knows they're not. Temin's seen that for himself. There's a distance there, and it's growing wider. And he decides it's all Nora's fault.
He's mad at me,
Nora says. She takes out her thermal carafe and pops the two discs out of the lid. Discs that, with a flick of her finger, become two small telescoping cups. She and Wedge retired to a small table around the back of the shuttle hangar, a place where some of the pilots, techs, and mechs eat meals on the job. She pours him a cup of Chava Chava, a hot brew from the root of the same name. It's no jaquad leaf chew, but it'll do. Wedge sighs.
I got that feeling. We're not really talking much now. Why? Is it you and Brenton?
Me and Brenton are fine. We're fine. Everything's fine.
She hears the stiffness in her voice. It's like she's got this cough in her chest, and she's trying not to let it out. But it tickles and scratches and hurts. And...
oh, damn it. It's not fine. It's not fine at all. Temin's right to be mad at me. His father comes home, and he's not present. Like, in his eyes. He's not there with us all the time. He's somewhere else, even when he's sitting right across from me.
Most of the captives are like that a little bit. I heard they were anesthetized, but they had nightmares.
That's right. Brenton probably underwent years of nightmares. And so the way he's acting is normal. It's more than normal. It's not his fault. And yet I can't get close. It's like he's just not Brenton anymore. And you're just not Nora anymore either. I blame myself. He'll get there. I have to be patient. I have to be nice and smile and just shut my fool mouth because he'll get there.
Wedge's hand finds her own. Their fingers enmesh. It's warm, and it's comforting. And she yanks it away.
I'm married. I know. I didn't mean... I know you didn't. I just mean...
Of course.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Don't apologize,
she says.
It felt good. And I want you to take my hand again.
And she grits her teeth while working to banish that thought.
Just tell me what's wrong with my son.
Nothing's wrong. He's actually scheduled to be on reserve for Liberation Day.
But?
But he's missed too much training.
She pinches her brow.
Which means he can't actually be on deck.
Right.
He's having a hard go of it right now. His father coming home has been all he's ever wanted, but the reality of that is far less than the magic we all expected.
She takes a long pull of the chava.
I'll tell him about Liberation Day.
You sure? I can tell him.
He's already mad at me. I might as well.
Thanks.
They sit there for a while, each wreathed in steam from the cups. She says finally,
any word from Kashyyyk?
None.
It's been a month, Wedge.
I know.
Leia must be losing her mind.
She is. Trust me, she is.
The Eleutherian Plaza outside the Senate building is abuzz with activity. All of it conducted by the masterful hand of Chancellor Mon Mothma and her advisors. She wields people like instruments, creating harmony and rhythm out of sheer noise. It is a thing to watch. Unless, of course, you are one of her discarded instruments. That is how Leia feels. But even if she is no longer contributing to the song, she can still bring noise, can't she? She rides up through the center of the plaza. She's showing now. No way to hide it. No way to avoid the whispers, either. Rumors of the child born of a smuggler and a princess. A smuggler who fled. A princess who stayed. Leia does not care about those whispers. She cannot. As Mon directs Senate guards, telling them where to stand, simultaneously fielding questions about the illuminations display that will fill the night sky after Liberation Day with an unparalleled show of lights and fire, Leia walks right up to stand in front of her. Forget protocol. Decorum is a thing of the past, a thing that Leia has buried deeply. Besides, Mon is a friend, isn't she?
Leia,
Mon says, in that voice. Leia detects the competing emotions of warmth and irritation. The Chancellor is pleased to see her, while annoyed by her interruption.
As you can see, I'm a bit busy.
Yes, I'm busy too. Busy worrying about my husband and his team and the entire world of Wookiees slowly being ground to dust in the crushing fist of the still-existent Empire. Mon, please.
Leia has been driven ceaselessly to find a solution to this crisis ever since that day the Millennium Falcon landed here in Chandrila, and her husband failed to meet her. Nora and the others rescued prisoners, but Han stayed behind. Something he had to do, Nora said. Her jaw clenches at that. Leia tried marshaling the votes needed to send aid and troops to Kashyyyk. But of course, the Senate is full of representatives whose own worlds need that aid. And sometimes the military presence, too. The vote was close, but not close enough. The measure will not return until the next cycle. And by then, it will be far too late. After that, she tried interfacing with Admiral Ackbar directly. Ackbar agreed that it was time to do something about Kashyyyk, and together they pondered the options. He considered sending a small Spec Forces team to the surface in order to help locate and assist Han's team. Mon Mothma blocked that effort, like slamming down a giant wall of ice between Leia and her goal. At the time, Mon said it would be inexcusable to stir mud into the water after Sloane came to them with the offer of peace talks. The galaxy, she said, was momentarily at peace. A tense, unpleasant peace, perhaps, but one where all was quiet on the galactic front. It was a much-needed respite from the weariness of war. And to make any formal, official incursion against Kashyyyk at this point could reawaken those troubles. That, the Chancellor made clear, was not an option. And the Senate backed her up.
Leia, please, if you give me a few hours...
Mon, stop! Listen to me! I won't negotiate on this!
Mon leans in and whispers,
I understand you're upset.
Understand this, Leia says, her voice louder than a whisper. You need me. I'm still the face of this Republic. Don't make me walk away from that.
Mon stiffens.
You'd really do that? You'd injure the New Republic over this?
I would burn down the whole galaxy if I thought it was right.
Mon sighs and forces a smile.
Ah, I do know that.
The Chancellor nods to everyone gathered.
Take a short break. I'll be back.
The Chancellor secures Leia's elbow, and the two of them walk to the far side of the plaza. Nearby, a trio of whiskered Volkites scurry about, searching for crumbs with scrabbling paws. Startled, the little animals take flight in a flurry of furry feathers.
You have my attention,
Mon says.
I wish you'd found a nicer way to secure it, but here we are.
We are friends, aren't we?
I expect and hope we still are. I know this is about Kashyyyk, and believe me when I tell you, my hands here are tied. Things are different now. In the days of the Alliance, we did what we could, and sometimes that meant individuals making snap decisions for the whole. But this is no longer an insurgency. We aren't in hiding. We don't operate in cells or in ragtag bases strewn across the galaxy. All eyes are on us. All hands are joined. We are united. And in that unity, we are beholden to the whole, to the machine of government, which is slow, yes, but effective.
Effective at what exactly? Indolence? Concession?
Compromise.
Such cold logic, and all while worlds die. What is our compromise on Kashyyyk? Because it seems to me there that no such compromise is manifested. Not a compromise that the Wookiees would understand.
Mon takes her hand and clasps it tight.
Kashyyyk is one world among the thousands we are trying to reach, and thousands more beyond that to come. Please, see beyond your entanglements with Han, and see that this is more than just one man.
Yes, you're right, it is. It's about millions of Wookiees, many of whom are already dead because nobody came to help them. Chewbacca is a friend and a protector. He is family, and I owe him just as Han owes him.
Awareness blooms inside her, fierce as a plume of fire.
She understands why Han is out there.
He's not running away from her or from the child.
He's running towards something. That's what Nora meant. He has something left to do.
Something that can't remain undone before he starts his own family.
I've been thinking,
Mon says.
And what Han is doing may be the right way to go about it. On worlds where the Empire still holds sway, or where criminal syndicates fill that void, individual resistance movements may rise up and serve as small rebellions all their own. Just like what happened to Makiva. We cannot officially support them, but we may be able to find ways through back channels to offer aid.
Leia scoffs.
Back channels? That's what we've earned?
As I told you before, I will also put this on the table with Admiral Sloan during our peace talks. I will ask that the liberation of Kashyyyk be a condition of peace.
You want to negotiate something that is non-negotiable,
Leia hisses. She holds up two hands, palms flat up.
Over here is the right thing, the good thing. On the other side is the wrong path, the evil path. We have long fought to be good, to be heroes. But now, you want to negotiate in this middle space. You want to dither about in the gray.
It's not as simple as good and evil, Leia.
It is to me.
Leia turns toward the door.
I'm not getting anywhere. I have to go, Mon. I thought I could try, but I can see it's futile.
Wait, Liberation Day is almost here. I need you by my side. The face of solidarity. Unity, as I said.
We have no unity on this. You will go at this alone.
It's not me who's alone, Leia.
A twist of the blade. Leia attacks right back.
I'd rather be alone than with you, Chancellor.
With that, she storms off, certain now what she must do. Nora finds her son standing alone in the kitchen. He's eating a Pakarna bowl, a kind of noodle concoction, a Chandrillan dish. Herbaceous and spicy. He twirls noodles onto a fork and shoves them unceremoniously into his mouth, sauce dribbling on his chin as Bone stares, rapt. The boy barely acknowledges her as she comes in the door.
Hi,
she says. He doesn't respond. Just a mopey nod is all she gets.
Where's your father?
What do you care?
Okay, I probably deserve that.
Temin shrugs.
Yeah, well, he's out. Again. On one of his walks.
He just needs to clear his head, honey.
What he needs is to get away from you.
That raises her hackles. She doesn't want it to.
Nora wants to lean into this.
To take her licks if they're earned. But fast, too fast, she's biting back at him.
Watch the attitude, Tim. We're all going through something. This is going to get tougher before it gets easier. Your father has been away a long time.
Because he was captured? What was your excuse?
I was trying to find him.
How'd that work out for you?
She ignores that, or tries to.
Your father's been a little strange because of what they did to him on that ship.
He's been strange because you've been strange with him.
He's right. She has. They eat dinner mostly in silence. The first week they slept in the same bed. But since then he's been falling asleep on the settee in the family room. They barely talk now. What should they talk about? The state of the galaxy? The upcoming peace talks with the people who put him in prison? The ones he fought against for years? What they speak of his nightmares? Her time with the Alliance? She's tried, in private moments, to probe at the edges of that. To tease out what he thinks of her following his footsteps. But mostly he just seems distracted. It's something she's seen with other pilots and soldiers in the war. They've been trauma-blasted to oblivion, ripped asunder, until they're just tattered scraps of who they once were. Is that Brenton now? Just tattered scraps? Can he be stitched back together? Can their marriage? Temin flings his noodle bowl into the sink, half-eaten. Bones cranes his neck and looks down at it.
I will clean that up.
No,
Temin says, hooking a finger around one of the robot's newly forged ribs.
Let's go somewhere else.
She catches his arm.
Wedge spoke to me. You've been missing training.
So?
So it means you can't participate in Liberation Day patrols.
He shrugs like it doesn't matter, even though the shrug is so aggressive it has to matter.
Whatever. Great. Liberation Day is dumb anyway. Peace talks with that monster Sloan. We freed some prisoners. Whoopee! They're not even giving us medals.
Temin!
No, you know what? It's fine. It's great. I'm gonna follow Dad's lead and go for a long walk. Alone. Come on, Bones.
If I go, then you won't be alone.
I said, come on!
Roger, roger!
Nora is left by herself, her eyes burning with tears. Her mind suddenly flies not to her husband, not to her son or Wedge, but to the team she left behind on Kashyyyk. She hopes they're okay.
Chapter 30 Lozen Tolrok, Grand Moff of Kashyyyk, is hunting. A visor sits strapped to his round face, and on each side small electro-stim pads are affixed to his temples. Through the visor, he sees and controls a small assassin probe. The probe was a droid once, though one of his techs removed the thing's personality matrix and turned it into something that Tolrok could control from afar. It's a mean little thing, that probe. Small enough to be tucked under one's arm. Fast as an arrow. Nimble, too, with perfect movement in every direction. It possesses a chroma coat of shimmer paint, allowing it to appear as if it blends in with the rest of its environment, providing it with powerful camouflage. It is a wonderful device. In theory. Lozen Tolrok despises it. Through the visor he sees his prey, one of the Wookiees they've been training. This one is subject 478-98, though Tolrok likes to give them nicknames. Makes it more personal. This one he calls Blackstripe, because of the single black stripe that bisects the center of the beast's face. Blackstripe runs, and Blackstripe climbs, but it matters little. The assassin probe is fast. It has thermal imaging and motion detection. It sees all, and can pursue with swift efficacy. The beast scrambles up one of the massive Rorschach trees in the garden preserve, and it ducks through branches and swings under spongy Jararatha vines and scrambles around clusters of blood-red needle blossoms. Blackstripe climbs and climbs, and soon the beast sees its hunter. It roars. Tolrock flinches as the beast's paw swipes across his vision. The probe flinches too, darting backward. The clumsy SWAT fails to connect. Tolrock merely thinks about what he wants to do, and the assassin probe does it. It barely needs to be a conscious thought. He blinks, and the probe extends a telescoping barrel, and then... two toxo darts stick in the beast's chest. The poison is fast-acting, and the Wookiee should fall. But he doesn't. He is robust. They trained him too well, it seems. Clumsily, the creature continues his ascent of the tree, moaning and gurgling as he leaps inelegantly from branch to branch. Fine! Anger seizes Tolrock. He roars the way the Wookiees roar, even though the beast will never hear that sound, given that the damn thing is over 60 kilometers away. And then he launches the assassin probe right at the wretched monster. Soon as it hits, he signals the elimination code, and the probe self-destructs. That will kill the awful thing. Blackstripe will be dead. A hole blown in the beast's back. Maybe it would even have split the monster in half. The visor goes dark. Tolrock rips it off his face with a growl. He dashes it to the ground and steps on it as if it is an offensive pest. There, in front of him, stands his attaché, Odair Bellopis. A capable man, Odair. Organized, merciless, Corellian. He is a brutal killer, yes, but also trustworthy. He has no designs on Tolrock's position. Odair is as necessary and as simple as a club held firm in one's hand. This thing, Tolrock growls, towing the broken control visor, is worthless to me. This isn't hunting, Odair. It's voyeuristic. I want to breathe air. I want to smell those ragged beasts. I want to hear their growls and their rasping breath. I want to chase them and be chased. That is the hunt. Not whatever this is. He paces around the room like the whirling winds of one of Kashyyyk's dreadful Mrazim storms. He runs his hands along the gnarled, knotted logs that make up the walls of his circular chamber. His thumb tracks across a line of sticky sap, and he brings it to his lips. He sucks that thumb the way a baby would. It gives him chills, and he shudders. A wave of pleasure washes over him. The sap, Horogathir, the Wookiees call it, becomes narcotic over time, after the wood is culled from the tree. He flops down in his chair, a massive skeletal thing formed of dark, dead wood. The many-pronged antlers of the Arathadir frame him as he slumps and slouches, pulling aside the fabric of his robe, made from the deer's own pelt, to scratch the expanse of pale, exposed belly.
You may speak if you have words,
Tolrock slurs.
I will tell the text that a new probe is necessary.
No! I want to go out. I want to hunt. Proper-like.
It's too dangerous right now.
Bah!
He sweeps his arm across the air.
This is no revolt. The Wookiees remain in our control. It's an insurgent cell. A little cancerous shadow clinging to our operation here. No more than a blood bug. Let's squash the Rathacon thing and be done with it. They can't hurt me.
They've been attacking vital targets, and you are our most vital.
With that, he won't argue. He is the lord of this world. The Empire has abandoned him. He is Grand Moff only in name. In truth, he is warlord. He is emperor. No! He is God.
An entire world and its feral species exist under his sway. What glorious power. He hated this place for so long, but now it's a part of him. Its dirt is under his nails. He stinks like it. And that stink? He likes it. He hasn't bathed in weeks. He's even taken to eating some of those Rorschach grubs whole and uncooked. Fat, plump worms whose skin pops when you bite them. Their guts evacuating their rubbery bodies and slicking his tongue. He wishes he had some now, even though he just ate not long ago.
He burps into his fist. His head lolls back. I refuse to be cowed, Odair. I will hunt these mongrels myself. We've already caught one of them. Maybe we can use him as bait. Get me my rifle.
There's something else, Governor.
Out with it, then.
We have a visitor.
Who?
An Imperial. One of Admiral Sloane's people.
That makes him sit up. Perhaps they have finally remembered him. Perhaps they hope to include him and his throne world in their empire. But then, that gives him pause. Does he want to join them? Does he care for their token advances? Their crumbs flicked into his waiting mouth? They will expect him to be gracious, but they have abandoned him here. He can do better on his own. Best to let this Imperial stew. Besides, Commandant Sardo has been pleading for a meeting now for some time. He'll take the call, and that'll give Sloane's lackey plenty of time to sit and simmer in regret. Then he'll meet with her man, finally, and when he does, he can send Sloane back a present. Her man's head in a footlocker. The Wookiees built many of their cities in and around the massive sky tower-like rocher trees. Trees whose trunks are of an unimaginable circumference. Big enough that to walk around the base of one could take you half a day. The trees turn and twist around one another, as if frozen in a mad dance. This, a competition for the boughs of each rocher to crest the upper atmosphere ahead of the one next to it. Each tree forever seeking the sun. The sun now is veiled behind bands of dark cloud and ash. Spears of light stab through that darkness, but even then the light is pale and thin. It feels insubstantial. It fails to bring warmth or even much illumination. What it does illuminate is that the Wookiee city of Arathaka is in ruins. The city once climbed the tree, as many of the cities do, following the bends and turns of the trunk. The life of the Wookiees was bound to the life of the tree. They tended to it, and in turn, it gave them shelter and food and all of their existence. Their symbiosis was honored as a bond both sacred and biological. But now, most of the city has been gouged from the bark. Pieces hang. The wood is burned in places, and so are the structures that were once affixed to, or grown into, the tree. The bond is broken. It was once a city of gardens. Now, it is only a city of ghosts. The Wookiees who dwelled there, though, are still near. Far below, down through the layers of mist, is Imperial Work Settlement number 121, a.k.a. Camp Sardo, after the man who runs the settlement, Commandant Theodane Sardo. It is one of many such settlements on the surface of Kashyyyk. All are built on the ground, for the Empire cares little to try to navigate the confusing topography of the Rorschers. Camp Sardo is also the largest of these settlements. It is home to over 50,000 Wookiees. They work in varying capacities. They dig up the roots of the tree. The roots are softer than the tree itself, and it is easier to make use of the wood there. They also mine the fungal nodes that cling to those roots. Mineral deposits form, attracting fungus to feed on those deposits. And once a node is mature, the fungus can be scraped away. Within is rochite, a hard, flinty crystal the color of gunsteel. Good for focusing imperial beam weapons, and worth a helmet load of credits on the black market. The Wookiees also grow food. They fight for entertainment. They are forced to breed. They are subject to various chemical and medical tests. And they do not revolt. They do not resist. Because if they do, the chips in their heads will end them. Or better yet, end their families. That is a trick it took the Empire too long to learn. A Wookiee will only fight so hard for herself. But they are slaves to their own bloodlines, and family is everything. Got a ruthless, undomesticated, willful Wookiee on your hands? Threaten those of her pack, and she becomes as pliable as warm dough. Still, sometimes the Wookiees starve, or are worked too hard, and when that happens, they are thrown into one of the carcass trenches and burned. Sardo brings in one new Wookiee for every other that falls.
Productivity is everything,
Sardo says over hologram. Tolruk grunts. The man is a sycophant, which is fine. Tolruk needs men like Sardo. Men willing to bow and scrape and lick boot. Just the same, it's disgusting to witness. Though Sardo is a great distance away in his camp, that man would never be invited within the walls of Lozen Tolruk's island fortress. His obsequiousness bleeds through.
The Empire may have left us behind, but you remain. And in your name, we seek to improve our margins. I've been trying to think of new ways to use the Wookiees.
Sardo goes on, explaining how the Empire has stopped bringing Wookiees off-world. It used to be that they would ship them away from the planet by the thousands for work. After all, it was Wookiees who helped build much of the Imperial War Machine.
But since that has ended, the breeding programs have become problematic. We have a surplus of slave labor, but what to do with it?
That is the conundrum Sardo puzzles over just now.
Could the Wookiees be farmed for their meat? Presently it's stringy and tough, but maybe if they could be fattened up or modified in some way, crossbred with another species perhaps, like the Talls.
Tolruk does not hate this idea. The Talls are delicious. Just then, the hollow of Sardo flinches. Tolruk asks,
What is this?
We've lost a turret, is all, in the trees.
Tolruk snorts. What's in the trees above Sardo? He glances at the map on the wall.
An old Wookiee city, isn't it? Arathaka.
Probably nothing.
Probably nothing indeed. Tolruk says,
Check on it anyway. Do not be lazy, Commandant. Control your environment. Do not disappoint me.
Sardo nods furiously.
I will, of course. Thank you, sir.
Tolruk nods back and ends the hollow. He sighs. He looks to Odair.
I suppose it is time we see what Sloane's fool wishes of me.
In the ghost city of Arathaka, a single ship eases in for a landing in the safety of a dead turret's shadow. It is an SS-54 gunship, or rather, light freighter. Its designation? The Halo. Lozen takes his time walking through the fortress. Fur-matted Wookiees and corroded droids work as he passes, many cutting thick planks of rosher wood to fortify the stronghold. That wood is damn near supernatural in terms of the protections it affords. It refuses to burn. It can take hits from a turbolaser and suffer only a little charring and splintering. Of course, that means cutting the stuff takes proton teeth saw blades. And even those break in contest with the wood. Many a Wookiee has had his head split in half like a Tongo nut by one snapping in mid-spin. The Wookiees do not look at him as he passes. They have been trained not to turn their animal gaze toward him. And the inhibitor chips bolted to the backs of their skulls ensure that any violation results in varying levels of misery, escalating, of course, until paralysis and then death. His feet splash in puddles as he walks from level to level, down one set of steps to another, around a wooden walkway, across a planking of sheet metal, through a longhouse of painted forest troopers readying their blaster rifles for target practice. Out here, the air smells of ash and char and burning hair. Clouds turn and twirl overhead, gray and dead as a diseased lung. There, ahead, waiting at the bottom of the rusted metal steps, the visitor. Classic stiff-backed imperial posture. Chin up, nose down, hands behind the back. The uniform shows a naval banding. Just a lieutenant. A man of little significance. The man offers a wan smile that lifts a mustache far too sculpted for this brutish world. Lozen's own beard is unkempt, unruly. A wild thatch scrub growing from his cheeks and jowls. Even O'Dare's face is a patchy rug of dark stubble. Mad men for a mad place. The Imperial salutes, then offers a hand. "Lieutenant Joran Turnbull," the man says. Lozen does not take the man's hand, or offer much acknowledgement at all. He does little more than twist his face into a dissatisfied scowl.
"Sloan sent you, I'm told."
"That is correct, sir."
"Why?"
"She understands you're having some, problems."
"And the Empire wants to help."
"We are all the Empire, sir."
"Are we?"
Lozen growls, then steps up to the man. O'Dare closes in, too. He is strung tight like a bow cable, ready for anything. The warlord gets into the lieutenant's face and bares his teeth. The man is small, and Lozen is large. He's let himself gain size over the last many years, filling himself with bulk, fat and muscle wreathing his bones. His beard is long, yes, but his hair is pulled back in a knotty snarl. He is everything this tall, thin man is not.
"You have abandoned us. Gone is our resupply. Our slave stock is building up, and nobody is taking them off our hands. We'll have to cut breeding lines before too long. We've seen no changing of the guard, no passing the baton for our ships, or our craft, or our officers. It is as if we are forgotten. But we remember, and we survive."
The man looks nervous now, as he should. He may die before this day is done.
"Grand Admiral Sloan surely begs your forgiveness in this regard. As you may know, the Empire has fractured since the Emperor's death."
"The Emperor is alive!"
Lozen seethes. It is a lie. He knows it to be one. And yet it's one he props up. The story he tells his men and women here is simple, because simple is effective. The Empire has been robbed from its Emperor, and one day he will reclaim it. Until then, they are on their own. It gives his soldiers a future. It gives them an end. It whispers of victory.
"Yes, of course."
The Imperial visibly swallows. He knows now that the rope coils around his neck and tightens ineluctably.
"Just the same, Sloan is extending a hand. You are menaced by terrorists?"
Lozen's eyes narrow into fat, pinched slits.
"Yes."
"We know who they are. We think. They came to this world with a stolen code from an Imperial prison maker."
"Golos Aram."
That is correct.
Never trust a Cynatine. A brain that large contains a multitude of treacheries.
That holds true here. The terrorists arrived with those codes, and under the false blessing of Admiral Sloane.
Lozen leans in.
Who are they?
Imperial hunters sent by the New Republic, led by a known scumraker, the criminal Han Solo. Now a general in their ranks.
Lozen nods. That makes sense.
Interesting. The one we have hasn't talked. Would not let a single word slip past his vile rebel lips, no matter how much we hurt him.
Do you still have him? Is he alive, the prisoner?
The governor snorts.
He is.
He holds up a finger and loops it in a lasso gesture.
Bring me the captive, Odair.
His attaché goes away and returns shortly with a short cage on grav pads. Odair nudges it along with his knee. The cage is too short for a human. It's an iron kennel meant for one of Lozen's striga, a blunt-beaked harrier bird, big as a dog and a powerful hunter. Trainable, too, with the right motivation. But this cage contains no such bird. Rather, it contains a man. This man belongs here. His eyes are wild like the forests of this place. He is rangy and savage, an undomesticated cur. The Imperial stoops to look. His face tightens as he sees.
This one, he's missing an eye.
We loosened that eye, thinking it would loosen his tongue.
Lozen growls mucus up out of his throat and into his mouth and chews on it.
It did not.
He spits the phlegm against the ground. Spat.
Well, your methods are your own. I could use a tour of your...
Just then, someone hands something to Odair. A hollow screen. Odair's gaze flits to the Imperial, then to the screen, then to Lozen.
Governor, you should see this.
Odair sidles over and hands him the hollow screen. On the screen, a series of wanted posters. This, he realizes, is the team of Imperial hunters that is plaguing him and his domain. He sees the man that is kept in the cage. A commando, looks like. John Burrell is his name. Thing is, he recognizes another face on there, too. Syngiarath Velus. It is the face of the Imperial in front of him. Oh, sure, the man has endeavored to change a little about himself. Hair a bit longer, and not to mention that overgroomed caterpillar crawling on his upper lip. But that, without a doubt, is not Joran Turnbull. If such a man even exists, he is an intruder. He is prey. Lozen feels his blood go hot.
What a wondrous reversal.
This man thought he could hunt the governor. But now this fool has gotten himself caught in a bind. And he senses it, too. Some prey is too dumb to know. But the best prey, the kind you want to hunt for the challenge it presents, can sense when the wind has changed, when a predator stalks the wild. The man tenses. His gaze flits because he's looking for a weapon or an exit or any advantage he can manage. But he's too slow. Lozen has a knife in his hand, a Kashak blade, a Wookiee weapon. The name translates roughly to bramble thorn. The beasts use them for eating. They pry open the shells of various crustaceans and bugs. But Lozen has found the blades to be elegantly balanced. So balanced, in fact, he throws it. The traitor turns to flee. The blade lands true. It sticks in the back of the man's calf, crippling his leg. His prey, Singier, whatever his name is, falls forward,
catching himself with open palms. His foe howls like a wounded deer.
Bring him to me!
Lozen barks to Odair. His attaché complies. Burned bone chimes tink and tonk in the unstill air. As Jazz sets up her rifle, snapping the scope on, one of the crew behind her, Greybok, the one-armed Wookiee, bumps something and it rolls past her. A toy. A child's toy. It is a wooden saurian with wheels instead of legs, and as it rolls, its jaw squeaks open and closed. She wonders how long it's been since a Wookiee youngling has played with it. That youngling might now be older, or dead. A shadow falls over her. Chewbacca stands staring out into the mist. He looks up, too, like he's equal parts sad and afraid. He chuffs and barks. Solo hunkers down next to her.
We'll keep our eyes peeled.
What did he say?
She asks him.
You don't want to know.
She screws the thermal imaging module onto the side of the scope.
I'm a big girl. I can handle it.
He said to watch out for spiders.
Spiders don't frighten me.
She thinks they sure frighten Sinjir, though. Even a teeny tiny house spider running across the floor will have him freeze in place, saying a prayer to 100 gods he doesn't believe in. It occurs to her suddenly, she misses Sinjir. Solo leans in.
Spiders don't frighten you because most spiders are no bigger than your hand. These spiders, web weavers, big as you and me.
That's horrifying.
What's more horrifying is what they do to you.
She blinks.
You're right. I don't want to know.
The Wookiees eat them. Chewie says they're, well, chewy.
Chewie yips in agreement. Just the same, she looks over her shoulder, half expecting to see some massive scuttling thing coming up fast. But all she sees back there is the halo and the team they brought on board. A ragtag crew of battle-hardened Wookiee refugees, plus a smattering of smugglers. That includes two of Greybok's friends, Hatchet and Palabar. It's Palabar who helped them conceive of this plan. The Quarren is utter poo-doo in a fight. Even the whisper of threat leaves him cowering and praying. But he's tech-savvy and smart, when he can see past his own fear. The crew is doing what they're supposed to, anchoring massive eye-bolts into the wood with pneumo-hammers. The wood resists, but the Wookiees know the weak spots. Once the eye-bolts are in, they start threading through the jump cables. Everything is going according to plan. Her mind drifts back to Sinjir and Jom, and she feels suddenly less relaxed. But there's no time for that distraction. Everyone has to do their part, her included. Jazz leans in and tucks the scope against her eye. It's comfortable. Sitting behind a gun is always comfortable for her. That probably says something unhealthy about her, but she doesn't care. Solo flips the thermal imaging switch.
Thanks,
she says, as the dead mist below suddenly flares with colors and contours. There. Camp Sardo, far below. The shape of a lumbering thing roams into view. An AT-AT walker slowly stomping along the perimeter. From up here, she can't even feel the vibrations of its feet. That's how high they are. She sees the great blob of life down there. Wookiees and forest troopers and the officers who belong to Lozen Tolruk's demonic regime.
You see it?
Solo asks.
Not yet.
Here, give me the rifle.
I have it,
she whispers.
Patient, Solo.
He yanks back his hand as if bitten.
Hey, all right. But put a little thrust in it, will you?
He looks up at Chewie.
How we doing, Chewie?
Chewbacca rumbles a reply.
Inhibitor frequency is still up, Solo says. But it could be down any minute. Come on, Amari, find the damn...
I found it, she says.
The shield generator gives off its own heat signature, and it's one of the taller structures in Camp Sardo. A dodecahedral tower on four steel posts. It controls the field that surrounds the camp. A field that Imperials can pass through without harm, but any chip that passes through it will detonate. Meaning, if a Wookiee waltzes through the field, boom. Unfortunately, it's an entirely separate mechanism from the inhibitor frequency, which means it has to go separately. But it can't go too early. They blow that field too early, and they'll set off alarms. That could compromise their plan.
I hope your pair can handle this, Solo growls.
Sinjir has it handled.
The commando, your boy toy there. He wasn't supposed to get captured.
She hesitates.
I hope he's all right. He also saved our hides and let us get away from that ambush. A fact I hope you appreciate.
Yeah, yeah.
He shifts impatiently.
And that explosive slug of yours will take that whole thing down? You sure about that?
It will,
she growls through clamped teeth.
Longer we sit up here, the bigger the target on our backs.
She gives him a look.
You need to trust us.
Yeah, yeah, relax. I trust Sinjir. I'm just on edge. And I trust you enough to take the shot when the frequency goes dead.
Me?
She smirks.
I thought you were Mr. Crackshot around here. The scoundrel with the luck of the Force on his side.
Here, how about this? We tell the world that I'm a better shot with a blaster, and you're a better shot with a rifle. We'll call it a draw.
She nods, says,
That's fair.
She likes Solo after all this, even with his boyish impatience. He gives off a vibe that floats somewhere between a sharp-tongued cad and a dim-witted oaf. But at the end of the day, there's something genuinely good about him. She likes to hope he sees the same in her.
All right, he says. Stay frosty, just in case we...
The mist around them lights up with a single laser spearing the air.
Good company,
he finishes, and then pivots on his heel with one blaster already up and in his hand. He yells to Jazz.
Stay here with Chewie. Get ready for the shot. We'll hold him off.
Coming up out of the mist behind them, and above, and below them, forest troopers in camouflaged armor. Everything lights up with the exchange of blaster fire. And Jazz hunkers down, jaw tight, trying not to die. John Borrell is in his cage, his one eye gone, and the men responsible are out there right now, about ready to kill Sinjir Rath Velis. He didn't recognize his crewmate at first. Having one eye didn't help, but Sinjir disappeared into the role of some needy bureaucrat. Tolruk bought it too. That ex-Imperial is good at his job. John Borrell appreciates those who are good at their jobs. Right now, though, Sinjir is also about to be good at getting his hind end handed to him by Lozen Tolruk's brute, Odair. John bangs against the cage, growling like an animal, his voice like two stones grinding together.
Get up! Get up, Rath Velis, you bloody sack of meat!
Odair advances. Sinjir moves fast, rolling over and pinwheeling a kick with his good leg. Odair doesn't see it coming. The kick knocks him down to the ground. Others gather around. Men of Tolruk's with mud on their cheeks and calloused hands. Women with leering stares, hungry for violence. Fights erupt here in the fortress from time to time. Sometimes they even make Jom fight, usually with one hand tied behind his back, because even half-blind, he still put his attackers in the dirt. All around, Tolruk's people hoot and call with the atavistic urgings of a primitive species. The two men scrap. Odair crashes an elbow against Sinjir's collarbone. But Sinjir bends back and fetches the blade from his own leg. It squishes and squirts a line of blood as he claims the knife as his own.
It's an opportunity, though, and O'Dare takes it, dropping a fist into his foe's gut again and again. It falls like the head of a hammer. Wham! Wham! It goes on like this for a while, the two men pummeling each other, the knife passing between them, the blade never drawing any more blood. Tolrok watches with eagerness, picking his teeth with a chipped thumbnail. John watches Tolrok. He thinks,
soon as I'm out of here, you're a dead man, Tolrok.
He's dreamed of taking the man's eye as vengeance for his own. When he was captured, the crew had been running the same two-prong approach that they started that day with the command station on the other side of Kashyyyk. Jom and his ground team did their commando recon business, in this case trying to secure a shuttle platform in order to grab an Imperial ride that would get them safely out to Tolrok's Island. But they were ambushed. Turns out they'd pulled the same trick too many times and gotten cozy with it. So did the local Imperials. Jom's team of Wookiees got away, but he wasn't so lucky. They captured him and brought him here. And that's where they cut out his eye. Suddenly, Tolrok applauds. Jom looks and sees O'Dare finally get behind Syngir. The brute pulls his arm tight around Rath Velis's throat. Eyes bulge, tongue wags.
Come on, Syngir! Give him hell! Fight! Fight!
The knife drops from Sinjir's hand and clatters to the ground. And with that, it's done. The crowd cheers. Jom slumps against the cage. His one chance at freedom, over. He shouldn't have sent Syngir. O'Dare spits out a pair of teeth, then drags the ex-Imperial over by his heel. Panting, he says,
Here he is, Governor.
Syngir rolls over. Jom winces. The man's a bloody, bruised, dark mess. The side of his face is swelling up like a balloon. His nose might be broken, and blood spackles that twisted mustache. Syngir licks his lips.
I'll be fine in a second. Then we can go for... He grimaces and grunts. Round two.
Tolrok lords over him, scratching his belly.
Why would you come here, into the heart of it, into my lair? Do you think me prey?
Not at all. Just looking to borrow a cup of sugar, love.
You came for your friend, then. The one-eyed man.
No, not that either, actually. I came for your...
Here he coughs so hard, it sounds like he might shatter a rib doing it.
Your control module.
A lantern of hope alights inside Jom's chest. At that, Tolrok barks laughter. The control module is how they program and control the chips in each of the Wookiees. It controls literally hundreds of thousands of chips. Jom's seen it. It's old tech, practically Clone Wars era. Tolrok probably barely understands how it works.
You idiot! I would never have let you get near that, no matter who you claim to be. The control module remains in my control only.
And yet...
More coughing.
It doesn't.
He frowns.
You are a sad, delusional little man.
Probably, but not about this, I'm afraid.
Syngir sits up. One eye now is sealed shut behind a tomb of swollen flesh.
See, you checked me for weapons at the door, but you did not check my boots. I've got a hyperwave transceiver spike hidden in my heel. And, so sorry, your precious console is of the transmitting variety. Totally wireless. An old security flaw, but one that remains mostly uncorrected across the Empire. I should know.
You... You didn't. You couldn't have.
I didn't need to be at the console to hack it. I just needed to be near it. Oh, of course, I also needed enough time for the remote hack to work, which I think you've given me enough just about now.
The datapad in Tolrock's left hand begins to flash red. The alarm. Now it's Jom's turn to bellow with laughter. He bangs his heels against the cage, cackling madly. To Odair, Tolrock screams,
"Kill the intruder! Kill him!"
A laser lances through the air, and Jazz hears it hit flesh. And next to her, one of the Wookiees, Hargan, topples off the platform. His body tumbles down into the mist, massive tree trunk arms pinwheeling. Every centimeter of Jazz wants to get up and take the fight to the troopers. They're surrounded now on damn near every side. They've got troopers behind them. And an LAIT, a low-altitude Imperial transport, keeps making flybys. The troopers within firing on them as they pass. On the latest pass, Chewie takes aim with a bowcaster, and the air sizzles as he clips one of the forest troopers right in the visor. The visor shatters, and the body rolls out of the transport, falling through the air and joining Hargan in death. But Jazz can't get up. She has her shot lined up. All she needs is... Chewie roars! The inhibitor frequency is dead! The chips are off, planet-wide. The revolt begins here and now, with the pull of her trigger. Her finger twitches, and the slug thrower bucks against her shoulder. Above Camp Sarda, a thunderclap explosion. Fire rains down in streams, and bits of the shield generator slam against the ground, crushing troopers underneath. Metal burns. Smoke rises. Around old Arathica, the mist pulses with what looks like red lightning. The shield is down. All around, Wookiees climb the towers, crawling on top of buildings, swarming over their troopers. A trio of them offer thunderous roars as they wrench a turret out of its mooring. Not far away, two Wookiees grab for one of the forest trooper guards. Each takes an end, and they twist. The trooper's spine snaps as his body corkscrews. They rage, fur and fangs and swiping limbs. Men screaming. In the distance, something explodes. Fire jets into the air. The beasts ululate. They are free. Fire blooms like a flower in the mist as the shield generator goes down. Around Jazz, the Wookiees roar and raise their arms and weapons in triumph. A small moment of victory before the next phase begins. Already Han is clipping himself onto one of the cables. He throws an anchor line to Chewie, who loops the cable around him and hooks it into his belt.
You good?
Han says to Jazz, flinching as a laser bolt cooks the air behind his head. He growls and returns fire. A trooper scream cuts through the mist, and she sees a shape fall.
I'm good.
We're almost there,
he says, his hand on her shoulder.
See you on the other side of this, Amari.
Good working with you, Sora.
To Chewie, he says,
come on, pal. Let's go steal us an Imperial Walker.
Then he and Chewbacca take a running leap off the platform. The two figures disappear over the edge, and then the other Wookiees join them. One by one, they leap boldly off the end of the platform, arms and legs splayed out as they dive through the mist toward the vile Camp Sardo, cables trailing like umbilical cords. That leaves her with her command crew, Greybok, Hatchet, and Palabar. Three ex-prisoners from Severkos who joined Solo's mission on a fluke. Hatchet claims she doesn't want to be here. Keeps saying things like,
I wanted to get away from prison planets, not take a vacation on one.
But then Greybok silences him with violent one-armed shaking. Palabar mostly just quivers and peeks out from behind his hands. They're the dregs of this team. Good thing Jazz likes the dregs. Already, they're waving her toward the halo. a pair of forest troopers come up a long spiraling ramp. One is already on her. So she cracks him hard enough with the butt of her gun that his helmet spins. The other gets a point-blank shot to the chest plate. It splits in half, and he goes down, his armor shattered and smoldering as he twitches. Hatchet waves her onto the halo.
"This is all going too good," he says. "It's gonna balance out the other way, Zabrak. Just you watch. Can't go nice forever. Shut up and man the guns,"
she tells him, then hops in the halo and kicks the thrusters into gear. They thunder to life, and the ship lifts into the air. Time to go rescue her friends. Everything is pulsing like a pounding heart. Sinjir gags as the man's hands wrap around his throat. Tolruk's attaché glares down with bloodshot eyes, a mad grin spreading across his face like a pool of spilling oil set aflame. Sinjir's hand swats uselessly at the man, then paws along the ground, feeling for the knife. A knife he knows can't be too far away. There! He has it! His fingers tickling the face of the hilt, and as darkness sucks at the edges of his vision, he tries to pull it close. Closer? Oh! A miscalculation. It spins out of his reach. Then, a shadow falls over him. Death, he decides. It is the specter of the end coming to claim him. He has part of it right. It is death, yes, but it hasn't come for him. One of the Wookiees brings the flat end of a circular saw blade against the side of Odair's head. Odair cries out and tumbles to the side. The Wookiee takes one stride, straddling the man. Then he flings the saw blade to the side and reaches to grab the man's arms. The freed slave begins to pull, pull, pull. Oh! Odair screams. Then comes the sound like branches breaking. It is a sound that fails to disturb him, for he knows its ilk well. The sounds of pain were once his song. No time to think about that now. Now it is time to move. He scrambles onto his hands and knees, only now regarding the chaos around him. Troopers are storming onto the scene, firing blasters. But the Wookiees, now freed, are not easily cowed by that. They roar.